Good afternoon, and welcome to Education Today. My name is Dr. Sarah McManus, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Education Today, an original program produced in the Triangle Radio Reading Service studio. In today's episode, we will be exploring audio description with Sina Baram, an accessibility consultant, researcher, and entrepreneur. Sina is the founder of Prime Access Consulting, or PAC, an accessibility firm whose clients include technology startups, research labs, Fortune 1000 companies, and both private and nationally funded museums. Today, we also wanted to tell you about one of our sponsors, which is RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh, North Carolina. Call 919-917-7729 for more information or visit www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. Welcome to our Education Today program, Sina.
Thank you for having me.
Very good. I gave the listeners just a little bit of information about you, but tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. So I have a background in technology. My undergraduate and graduate degrees are in computer science, and I'm ABD. I'm all but dissertation in a PhD in computer science. So I spend a lot of time in school thinking about and understanding how technology works and how computer systems can be architected. And my focus when doing that was how we can use technology not only to make the electronic world more accessible to persons with disabilities, but to make the real world accessible as well. And in the course of doing that, I discovered that a lot of these benefits aren't just for someone with a disability, like myself, I happen to be blind, but are helpful to absolutely everybody, regardless of functional ability.
Excellent, excellent. And it says here that you also do a lot with museums. Tell us a little bit about the museum work that you do.
Sure. So over the past 5 or so years, I've really retooled the company and our firm just to concentrate on the cultural heritage sector. So this is galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. Sometimes you'll hear me refer to it as the glam sector. It's a really interesting space for me. Museums have a wealth of knowledge. They have a whole host of different experiences and different things to explore, sometimes multimodal experiences where you're using different senses, not just your eyes, but sound and haptics, you know, feeling things, etc. But they're not always the most accessible, especially for persons with disabilities or somebody who just forgot their reading glasses that day. And so I wanted to spend a little bit of time saying, hey, you know, these museums, they have these cool things inside, these incredible stories and narratives to tell, but they're not making it fully accessible. And so I've been working with a lot of them on different techniques that we can use, things like inclusive design and universal design, so that when you design an exhibit or a show or a particular object that you want to feature in the museum, how do you do so and consider all audiences up front instead of just someone who will be able to see the text on the wall or who will be able to hear the audio from a video, etc.?
Wow. And so have you worked with any museums here in the Raleigh area?
Very few. So we've done a little bit of project. There's a couple of outdoor sculptures in Durham, for example. And we worked a little bit with some folks at Duke on that particular project. But it's kind of ironic. I spend so much time traveling away from North Carolina. So many of my clients are actually outside of the state.
Oh, wow. Well, tell us about one of the museums you worked with where they started with inclusive design, starting from scratch.
So a museum that did that absolutely from scratch would be the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. So this is a museum up in Winnipeg, Canada, and it was a parking lot when we first got started.
Wow.
This did not exist as a museum. And it slowly came together, and it involved many, many different vendors. So we're talking 20, 30, 40 different technology companies, all making different kinds of exhibits, touch screens, touch tables that are as big as a pool table, if not larger, right? And so multi-person, multi-touch, things involving Microsoft's Kinect, which uses computer vision to see where you are and to bring up different content on the screen. And so this is a large building with a lot of different interactive technology. How do you then start from scratch and say, okay, full stop, mm-hmm. we're going to put inclusive design into everything this institution does? And they did that, by the way. They started from the beginning. Yeah. They looped me into the pipeline. And so I was working very closely with their executive producer, Bruce Wyman, and their vice president in charge of all of exhibits, Corey Timpson, and a few other just key personnel there, like Scott Gillum. And we were just, it was a fire hose. You know, there's all of these different projects going on, all independent of one another, but you have to ensure a consistent approach to things like language and mm-hmm. accessibility. How do you make these interfaces talk and have keypads so that they can be accessible? Because remember, this was about 5 or 6 years ago. So iOS and iPhone touchscreen accessibility, it wasn't where it is right now. These days, it's ubiquitous. We just assume, an iPad is accessible. But back then, that was in the early days of that technology. So one of the things the museum did was they put these keypads behind every single exhibit. Mm-hmm. And so, in front of them. And so there's a floor detectable marker. You can detect that with your cane uh-huh. or with your foot. You follow that up vertically. You know that there's a keypad there. There's a headphone jack there. There's Bluetooth that will communicate with your phone. There's a Braille label with a number on it that you can type into an iPhone app and get more information about the exhibit. Or you can listen if you don't have your phone. And so it's all about choice, right? Like those kinds of things where, why are there two things? Why is there a number that you can listen to on your phone and also a keypad? Because we want to return agency and choice back to the visitor, not just say this is the one way you can interact with it, but try not to make so many assumptions about how people would prefer to interact with things. And so all of the content there has audio description. It has captioning in both English and French, because remember, it's Canada, so they have a dual language thing to be aware of there. They have audio description, as I said, and they also have the ability to be raised in volume if you're deaf or hard of hearing mm-hmm. and just want to hear it at a higher volume, et cetera, et cetera. So all these considerations went into every exhibit. And the trick of it was, yes, there's a lot going on. Yes, it's a fire hose of content on a weekly basis. But the key decision that was made was, let's insert accessibility into the pipeline at the beginning. Let's follow the principles of inclusive and universal design. And what ended up happening by just making those couple of decisions up front is that when the museum opened, it was fully accessible. It was fully available to visitors regardless of functional ability, which is, to this day, a really cool thing to me.
Yeah. And what kind of impact do you think that would have with persons who have a disability or just any person who goes to the museum?
Yeah. So a common, I don't want to say misconception, because there's some truth to it, right? Amongst especially persons with disabilities is, museums are not for me, right? There's nothing there for me, right? It's an art museum and I'm blind. Why would I go there? There's going to be a lot of things behind glass or other things I can't touch. And so dispelling that sort of myth on both ends is really important in the work that we do. And when I mean on both ends, what I mean is, it's not only visitors with disabilities that have that misconception, right? Museums have that misconception. Yeah. So museums are like, well, we're an art museum. Blind people don't come visit us. It's like, well, wait a minute. Why not? And whose fault is that, right? Let's fix that. And so now there's this shift that's happening with museums. This is true in art museums. This is true in science museums, where and content-based, concept museums like the one for human rights, where they're saying, okay, let's reset the way we're thinking about this. This is not, let's do some things for our disabled visitors. That's not the approach here. This is, we're doing those things that are right to do for all visitors. And yes, it happens to be critical, for example, that Braille number or that talking interface, critical if you can't see. But again, the fact that we made the font size adjustable on a display, uh-huh. that's useful for, let's say, if you just forgot your reading glasses one day, or maybe you were contacts and they were bothering you, you just took them out, you can dial the text up and still enjoy that experience with your kids without having to think, I got to get all up close to the screen, or I'm going to look awkward, etc. So it's just this feeling of inclusion you're trying to promulgate from design all the way to production, if that makes sense.
Excellent. And let's talk about audio description a little bit.
Sure.
So we talked about it on our program last time, where we talked about audio description for theater.
Mm-hmm.
When people go to the theater and there's lots of things happening on the stage where you know, somebody who's there and can't see wouldn't know that it was happening.
Right.
And so there's audio description for that. We also talked about going to the movie, and there's audio description there. Mm-hmm. But those who weren't with us on our last program may not know what audio description is necessarily.
Sure.
So can you just give us a brief definition of
it? Yeah, of course. So audio description, especially when we talk about time-based media, like a movie or something like that, is the act of describing in audio what's going on visually, right? But you're not describing every little thing. You're describing those things that someone can't pick up on by listening to the conversation or listening to the show. You don't have to say a car is going by if someone can hear the engine. On the other hand, if it's really, really important for an action sequence to know that that's a undercover police car, mm-hmm. well, then that's something that you should say in the visual description. And so this is available on Netflix and other popular services. And what we do in the museum world is use that same approach, but use it to describe art and artworks.
Oh, tell us a little bit about how that would work, because an artwork is just, you know, it's a piece of art,
mm-hmm.
but how do you make it come alive?
Right. So there is this common thing around, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. And we're not at 1,000 right now, but 300 seems to be a really good long description length. And so what we do is we encourage institutions to author different forms of audio description. One form is a short audio description. You could imagine this is something you would encounter on a website where if you're reading with a screen reader or other assistive technology, it would describe the image to you, but only in around 20 or 30 words.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a long description, a longer form description that really dives in, tells you about foreground and background, perspective, the subject of the painting, let's say, and the style, explains a little bit about the mood that's being, you know, evoked about, the, you know, within the painting, etc. Those are longer form descriptions, and those are between 150 to 300 words. And so what we do is we work with institutions to create those descriptions and then surface them in different ways, whether it's on their website or in an audio tour, like in an audio guide, or whether it's on an iPhone app that can be read with your own assistive technology. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone who's deaf-blind. How do you make sure that it's accessible for somebody who has both hearing and vision impairment, right? So
right.
we can surface that on an iPhone app or on a website where then on a Braille display, you can also read that information. So that whole element of inclusion still needs to be at the core of just thinking about not only doing these things like writing the audio description, but then how do you surface it in an accessible way for everybody?
Wow. I can see that being very helpful for me because sometimes I look at a piece of art and I'm like, I wonder what this is telling me.
It is fascinating that you mentioned that.
Uh-huh.
So we've worked now with lots of institutions doing this kind of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we do, just like I said, is not only surface it and run it by people who are blind or low vision, but just regular visitors that are just there, happen to be there. And we ask them, what do you think about this? You know, what's the feedback, right? The amount of feedback we get is incredible on this type of thing being helpful to everybody.
Oh, wow.
The number one feeling that most people have when they go to a modern art museum, okay, is dumb. They feel dumb.
Mm-hmm.
They say this on
yeah,
you ask surveys.
Like,
why is this important?
Uh-huh.
I'm told this is really important or expensive or old, but why do I value this? Like why is this a good thing, right? And so a lot of people feel that way, regardless of whether they can see the paintings. When you present those same folks in the gallery a visual description, originally, remember, authored maybe for someone who can't see,
mm-hmm.
but you present it to everybody, they all of a sudden treat that as an act of guided viewing. They say, oh, wait a minute, I never realized that shadow in the background was supposed to be a boat.
Mm-hmm.
I get it now. That's really, really cool. And so it's this interesting effect that, again, it's this visual description that may be authored for someone who can't see, but everyone gets use out of it and get some value out of that.
Excellent, excellent. And so you told us specifically about the museum in Canada that
mm-hmm.
you worked with. Tell us about some of the other museums you've worked with around the country.
Absolutely. So there's a San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. There's SF MoMA. They had a large, it's called like a triptych or a triptych display. So imagine a three vertical touch screens, right?
Okay.
You know, kind of like an iPad, but as big as we are. So as tall as you and I are and as wide, let's say a foot and a half or so wide and three of them side by side. So you can imagine
wow.
this touch wall where you can go and you can touch the wall. Now, how in the world do you make that accessible? impossible for somebody who can't see or somebody who can't use both hands. So the design challenge I gave those guys was, we're going to make this accessible with one finger. With one touch point, we're going to make this whole experience accessible. So there's a Braille label. You can plug some headphones in. It turns on a built-in screen reading tool. They actually wrote that from scratch, the Bell & Whistle, the company that worked on that. And you can explore the artworks. You can swipe through just like you can on an iPhone or iPad. You get instructions about how to do that. And you can hear the descriptions of the different artworks. And your friend, who let's say you're there with a sighted friend, they can be standing in front of you using that same interface. It's not a separate one. It's not one off to the side. That's really important. It's the same interface that's just made accessible for everybody. So you can collaborate and say, oh, look at this one. No, look at that one. That one's really cool. And you can have that collaborative experience together, as opposed to, let me go turn on speech mode and go off to the side here and use the separate thing. And, you know, that's, again, that feeling of inclusion, bringing that to the core of the project.
Excellent.
And we've done similar work with, the Andy Warhol Museum with tactile replicas, where you can actually touch the artworks.
Mm-hmm.
And also work with Cooper Hewitt up in New York, the Design Museum, trying to make their exhibits and their space accessible to everyone. They're working on an accessible label project right now, where they want to commit to putting Braille beside every single label in the institution.
Wow.
And having an iPhone app where you can read the accessible, not only the accessible label copy, but also the visual descriptions that we talked about for all of those objects.
Excellent. And tell us a little bit about the websites, because
sometimes,
we can't visit.
That's
so
exactly right.
We can always go on the web and find things.
So one example would be the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. So the MCA, they are doing an incredible job with web accessibility. They redesigned their website a few years ago, and they are very design forward. We're talking all the fancy stuff.
Oh, yeah?
All right. Really, really design forward. But here's the thing. They had also a commitment that even though they're going to be super design forward, they want to make it accessible. They want to make it 100% inclusively designed. And so they're authoring visual descriptions for the artworks. You can see this right now. If you go to mcachicago.org, there's a button that you can use visually or that I can use with a screen reader that will surface the visual descriptions right there on your screen for all of the artworks.
Wow.
So not only can I appreciate it because it's in the alt text and my screen reader or my Braille display will present it, but you as a sighted user could go and click on it and experience it. And going back to that thing about how this is for everybody. So they're not only making the website accessible and making sure it's usable by persons with disabilities, but taking that commitment to accessibility and actually surfacing it on the website so you can browse through the art and enjoy yourself even if you can't see the pictures.
Excellent. I can see how teachers would be able to use that in their art classes with
students. Absolutely. Just as a form of guided viewing and thinking about how to think about how to talk about art, right?
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, I also have some more information about you as an individual that I'd like to share with the audience. It seems you were recognized by the White House as a champion of change in 2012 by President Barack Obama. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Sure. So that's how I got into museums. I was at the White House. It was just this huge honor and receiving an award for some of the work that was related to my previous PhD work and some advances in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and some of the accessibility work I'd done in that space. And while I was there, one of my fellow award recipients was this woman named Christine from the Museum of Science in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, listen, there's going to be this workshop next week. We've been planning this thing for months, but you're coming to this, okay? It's like, okay, apparently I'm coming to this. And so they fly me up to Boston, and I hang out for a week with the coolest museum and technology people. It was a mix of computer science people and museum people, and that's where I really started falling in love again with museums, but now with this added emphasis of, wait a minute, we know how to make some of these things accessible. Why don't we do some work in this space? And so that's how I got actually into museums. After that workshop, I really started working with more and more museums, started going to museum conferences and really just, making a lot of great contacts and friends in that space.
Just glamming it out, right?
That glamming it out. And that's, I haven't looked back. We still do a lot of work with, don't get me wrong, some startups and universities and law firms and things like that. But the majority of our clients these days, all museums.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. It also says here you now go to the Nobility Community Heroes of Accessibility Awards. Did you get an award?
I did. I was in, I believe, 2015, if I'm not mistaken. That was really a pleasure. It was a, I think it was a, one of those, you know, people to watch sort of things, you know, awards. Okay. So no, it's one of those awards that also comes with a, no pressure.
No pressure. They're watching you.
That's right. But that was really nice. That was at the CSUN conference that was presented a few years back, which is the annual technology conference for persons with disabilities that's run by the California State University in Northridge.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. And then also it says you co-chair the 2017 Museums and Web Conference.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I mean, it was really, really fun. So Museums and the Web is one of the leading conferences in the museum space.
Okay.
And Museums and the Web, and there's another one called MCN. These are two very popular technology conferences. And so Museums and the Web is one of the major organizers and founder folks who run the conference is named Nancy Proctor, and she has been pushing accessibility for the longest time before I got on the museum space, and she's been just championing accessibility for the longest time. And she brought me into that conference several years ago and said, "You need to be part of this community. You need to connect with these people." And I've been grateful ever since, been participating in that conference. So in 2017, I was really, really just privileged to be asked to co-chair that, and that was a fantastic experience. I'm really looking forward to this year's conference. It's going to be up in Vancouver, and there's some new guest co-chairs that I'm really looking forward to. And it's just one of those core, you know, it's one of those core conferences that I go to every year, and that's my tribe. Those are where the museum people are, and that's where we talk about these types of projects that we've talked about on this this episode.
Yeah, and to be a co-chair, that's phenomenal. It was a
really big honor. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So one thing that we always try to encourage our folks who are listening is to advocate for themselves. So what advice would you have for someone who says, you know, I want to go to the museum and I want it to be accessible for me? What should they think about before they go?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things. Right now, and we're working on this as a community, but right now, lead time is a really big important thing. So museums oftentimes don't have the resources to keep a docent on standby for a guided tour or to, you know, have like a touch tour set up where it can be accessed on a daily basis with a walk-in. So the biggest thing that you can do to have a better experience is to call ahead. And I don't like that state of affairs. I think that's frustrating. Sometimes I'm in a new city. I'm just going to be in San Francisco for a night. I'd love to just pop into a museum, right? But that's something we're working on as a community. Right now, though, if you can call ahead and figure out the specific things that museum that you want to go to has, you'll have a better experience when you get there. You can give them a heads up. And just keep in mind that a lot of these institutions, they're labors of love. You know, this is not a well-funded billion-dollar corporation. This is a museum that's very much bootstrapped and very much dependent on donations. And just ground, you know, just contributions from you and, you know, people like you and me, you know? And so it's one of those things where if you can give them a little bit of a heads up, they will try to work with you. And then later on, you can use that as an excuse to open the conversation about, oh, well, here are some things that you could do for all deaf visitors. Or here's some things. I noticed that you guys had a video playing in the lobby, but there's no captions. Would it be possible to get that captioned, you know? So it's sometimes baby steps. It's not, oh, well, this, and this isn't working, you know, why go? It's one of those things where if you're interested in museums and you want to have a great experience, go there, but sometimes you might need to visit multiple times and you might need to establish a relationship with them. It's something I'm hoping to change, and, you know, it's one of those things where wouldn't it be great just to be a visitor and pop in and not have to help people make things accessible? And that's definitely true, but it's a growing, you know, it's an iterative process right now. Does that make sense?
It does. Baby steps, too. And I think it's important to have those relationships. Because if they know you're coming, they're going to want to do something for you.
Yeah, it's just people on the other
friends.
End. Yeah, exactly. And it's just people on the other end. Like, they want to do right by their visitors. They really sincerely do. I cannot tell you the nice people. Like, one of the reasons I work so much with museums is these are also my friends. Like, they're just amazing people. And sometimes they don't know what the best practices are, or they didn't know that they've been ignoring this visitor base for 20, 30 years. So it's about education and just being welcoming on both ends, as opposed to, you know, assuming that everybody knows all the good things to do, and then they're actively not doing it.
Yeah. And this program, the content is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, mm-hmm. but they, others might be listening as well. How do people get involved? Is there a way they could test some of the audio descriptions?
Absolutely. Or? Well, so some of the ways is if you're interested in doing like local testing and that sort of thing, I'm happy to talk with anybody who's interested in that, because sometimes museums will call me up and say, we need some testers for X, Y, and Z, or we need some, somebody to evaluate this type of interface versus that kind of interface. So those types of things are definitely possible. The other one is that museums sometimes have advisory panels or mm-hmm. groups okay. where you as a member of the visitorship with a disability can join that group and then give some advice on new and upcoming exhibits. So it's on a per museum basis, but reach out to somebody in education or visitor services and make it known that you're wanting to help and take the conversation from there.
Excellent. Well, we've almost run out of time, but I did want to leave space for you to just give any information to the audience that you'd like to share things up.
Yeah, I'm definitely happy to talk with anybody further about museum accessibility and inclusive design. I'm sure it will include some contact information in the show notes and on the website, so you can reach me on there. I'll go ahead and say my email address here, just to spell it out. It's Sina, S-I-N-A, at SinaBaram.com, SinaBaram.com, Sina@SinaBaram.com. And I'm happy to hear from anybody in the museum world, or if you're wanting to just go to a museum and have a fun and accessible experience. And I would encourage people to reach out to their local museums and art galleries and things of this nature and just begin those conversations, because a lot of it just starts from that simple, oh, I never thought about somebody who can't hear visiting my establishment or visiting my institution. And then from there, it can grow into a project or an accessibility effort at the museum.
Excellent. And give them that website one more time.
Sure. So the email address that I was giving before is Sina@SinaBaram.com. And I'll spell it again, Sina@SinaBaram.com.
Okay. Excellent. So that's your email address.
That's my email.
Is there a website that can be used as well?
I've been thinking of actually putting together a resource list. This is one of those things where you should never talk about something before you release it, but I'm happy to hold myself a little bit to this. So the next time we talk, I owe you a page, because it's something I've been wanting to put together now for a while on the company website, is a resource list of accessible museum projects that are going on around the country. And so I do put that together over the next month or two, I owe you a return visit so we can talk about that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Sina, for being with us today. And you've shared a lot about audio descriptions or visual descriptions for artwork in the museum world. And we hope that our visitors will take you up on your offer if they'd like to be involved and being a tester for some of the things that you've put out.
Yeah.
And then also just your challenge to, go to a museum, form a relationship with the staff that's there, let them know that you're coming, and enjoy the artwork.
That's right.
So we're going to close out. We hope you've enjoyed our show today. Our sponsor is RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh, North Carolina. Call 919-917-7729 for more information or visit www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After its broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. That's www.triangleadingservice.org. TriangleReadingService.org, where you'll find and be able to listen to this program again and share it with others. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. You may also reach us via email at info@trrsnc.org. We look forward to hearing from you again, and so long until next time.